It's time now for our Golf Today Roundtable with the aforementioned Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner. Gentlemen, always nice to see you, Lav. I'll begin with you, Shane Lowry. We know him as a Ryder Cup stud. I was at home on the couch watching golf. Just your big kind of 30,000-foot takeaway from what we all experienced as golf viewers yesterday.
It was shocking, Damon. It was nothing short of utterly shocking. And Rex and I recorded the show, the aforementioned show, the pod show, about 30 minutes after the final putt dropped on Sunday. And I think we were still trying to grapple with exactly what unfolded over the final 45 minutes at PGA National. And I remarked to Rex, almost tongue-in-cheek, like, this is the duality of man, is it not? It's certainly the duality of a professional golfer, where here's a player in Shane Lowry who has stood tall in some of the toughest environments a professional golfer can face. 2019 Open Championship, trying to win in front of his home fans, accomplished that. He won the BMW PGA, the European Tour's flagship event, over Jon Rahm and Rory McIlroy. Ryder Cup last fall, birdied two of his last four holes to tie Russell Henley and earned the clinching point for the Europeans. That is all great. Conversely, he's also had a couple memorable miscues. Think back to the 2016 U.S. Open, bogeying two of the last three holes last year at the Truist affiliate Cricket Club. He's now just 1-for-6 with a 54-hole lead. Shane Lowry has a reputation as a world-class player, and yet his PGA Tour resume says good but not great. It's confusing, it's confounding, it's complex, but you guys mentioned it in the last segment. That is why we watched. That was sports at its finest. Misery, elation, all in 45 minutes.
Rex, how did you take it all in?
Lab missed out on shock, because I think most of us were shocked who were watching it on property, because he had been moving along so well. You look at what he had done, specifically with his irons. I mean, strokes gained approach, strokes gained tee to green. He was blowing the field away. And then to lose it with an iron in your hand, he had played 69 sublime holes. And it was just those last three that really undid him. And Lab brings up just an excellent point that you can, there's evidence to suggest that, yes, he's the type of player that struggles on Sunday. And yes, he's the type of player that can get it done on Sunday because of all of the things that he's accomplished in his career. We had Brad Faxon on the show. You mentioned the boots on the ground segment that we do. Fax worked with Dr. Bob Rotella when he was playing professional golf. Bob Rotella was there on Sunday talking with Shane Lowry. I can only imagine what the conversation was like afterwards, because a world-class player by every measure in that particular situation, essentially at his home event, shock is the only thing I could think of.
Lav, like Tommy Fleetwood before him, Shane decided to speak to the media after his final round on Sunday, after that heartbreak. Could we see a cathartic moment this week at Bay Hill or sometime down the road, because he was able to kind of unburden himself, was honest about the disappointment and the broken heart he was feeling?
Yeah, huge respect for Shane Lowry for meeting the media. I don't think anyone would have faulted Shane for blowing off the media, saying, I'll see you Tuesday at Bay Hill, and maybe we can get an explanation there. And this is going to sound very selfish. This is going to sound very self-serving, because as a reporter, we want to have these sort of interviews with a player who was really in the arena. But in the sound that you guys ran, it was about two and a half minutes. We learned a whole lot about Shane Lowry in what is a very limited amount of time. We learned that he lost control of the club face over the final three holes. We learned, and he explained the disappointment that he was feeling. He talked and shared the anecdote about wanting to share a really special moment with his four-year-old daughter on the 18th green. That was all possible because he took the time and really held himself accountable. And so I have a massive respect for a player who was in the arena and decided to do that. It really helps fans with understanding the context for what happens. And now I think as golf fans and golf observers, you have a reason to root for Shane Lowry now. And that's why I think the comp with Tommy Fleetwood is so apropos. You think about the Travelers Championship and the way that he lost that, the way that he confronted his demons, the way that he talked and confronted those issues head on. He was able to cash in a couple of months later. I think a similar thing could certainly happen to Shane Lowry. First in Dubai, now in the Palm Beaches. He's accumulated scar tissue, certainly, but I think the direct manner in which he has confronted the demons and tried to explain away the issues he's feeling could actually be very, very helpful for the remainder of 2026.
Rex, how about Nico? Right place, right time, right shots down the stretch, and it was the right mix to get his third win on the PGA Tour, not just carrying the mantle for Colombian golf, but really emerging as the next talent with South American golf now with that third win on tour.
George, you and I both have been in that situation. He had a house to pay for. His wife just bought a house on Friday. That's going to motivate you to work pretty hard. You're going to have to finish it off knowing you're going to have to put some probably into a renovation. She might want a pool. There's a lot talk about here. But I think it's an amazing it's the kitchen. I think it's an amazing conversation. I can confirm he does have the shield from the international team on his phone. I noticed that earlier in the week. It would mean the world for him to be on that team, to have Camilo Villegas as his assistant captain, to play his way on after what has been really a journeyman career. I think at least a journeyman few years for him. I was fascinated, and you guys ran the interview I did with him, about how everything sort of happened in that moment. He was playing in the group ahead of Shane. He noticed that Shane's caddy was sort of running back and forth in the fairway on the 16th hole after he puts his tee shot into the water. And I can only imagine how quickly the gears started to turn on one of the hardest holes on the golf course. It's the Bear Trap, but that 17th hole had played so demanding all week long. We talk about Shane not executing the shots. That's an amazing shot that Nico pulled off on 17.
Rex, back to you real quick about the future of the Cognizant, where Rory became number one back in 2012, holding off a hard-charging Tiger Woods, where Jack goes into the booth every year and speaks to Dan Hicks, where folks go take a selfie with the bear at the Bear Trap. What is the future of this historic event that seems to be searching for bodies inside the top 25? They were bereft of that this year.
I think there was a lot of hand-wringing last week, and for good reason. I mean, we've spent a lot of time over the last few months talking about what the future PGA Tour schedule is going to look like, and if the idea is going to be less is more, which Tiger Woods put voice to that last year in December at the Bahamas when he sort of talked about the work of the future competitions committee. If you're an event like the Cognizant Classic, and I'm not trying to pick on them, but this is pretty obvious, you're probably looking yourself in the mirror thinking to yourself, are we expendable? Are we going to be on the wrong end of less is more? And you pointed out the field last week. Not one player out of the top 25 in the world. This isn't a Cognizant Classic problem. To be fair, they have an awful spot on the schedule. You're wedged in between two signature events that are player hosted between Genesis, Tiger Woods, and the Arnold Palmer Invitational, Arnold Palmer, the very next week. And then, oh yeah, on the bookends of that, you had Pebble Beach, and then you had the Players Championship coming up in a few weeks. Even for the players that live in South Florida, 5 weeks in a row is asking too much. And that's the problem that you end up with tournaments like this. We talked about this on the podcast last night. I do want to stress that of all the hand-wringing last week about the future of the Cognizant Classic, I think we probably need to pump the brakes a little bit on what the future schedule might look like, because by all accounts, they're still trying to figure out themselves.
Well, and Lab, that's kind of the next chapter for Brian Rolapp, his first big move, roster-related. Then you get to schedule-related, and you have tournament organizers and title sponsors who want to be in business with the PGA Tour. You have Golf Channel, CBS, NBC, all these networks that want to broadcast these events, players who want more opportunities. So then how do you define scarcity and what's the right balance?
Yeah, I think that's the big question that Brian Rolapp, hopefully we're going to have some answers in the next 8 or 9 days when he's expected to meet with reporters ahead of the Players' Championship. I think, George, when he looks like specifically at the Cognizant Classic, it's a really interesting situation because the golf course at PGA National is recognizable. It's familiar to golf fans. I think that counts for something. And there's this big focus. I talked to Lee Smith, the executive director of the Players' Championship, a couple of weeks ago when he was honing down on one of the three main talking points for the players and what the future model is going to look like. He was owned the summer, getting into the biggest markets, which I think is applicable here because, you know, West Palm Beach is not the biggest market, but either is Hilton Head. And no one's talking about getting rid of the RBC heritage. And so this is still a golf mad community, a community I think the PGA Tour should be targeting. The big question though, as Rex pointed out, is the schedule and the jockeying for position, trying to make each and every stop desirable for the top players in the world. You look at the last 6 years of the Cognizant Classic, just three top 10 players in the world have teed it up in it. If you move it up in the schedule, if you make it the second or third week of the PGA Tour schedule, all of a sudden you have players who have been, you know, without playing opportunities for the past 4 or 5 months, desperate to get onto the golf course and desperate, I think, to play a golf tournament 30 minutes from their home in most cases. So I think a simple schedule adjustment could really benefit tournaments like this. But when you zoom out, that's going to be the case for all of these tournaments. They're trying to jockey for position, making sure they're best suited to nab as many of the best players in the world as humanly possible.
Yeah, one of the big names in the field this past week was Brooks Koepka. We'll get into his week in just a little bit. But first, some news on this Monday. Before we go to break, the PGA of America, USA Sports, and NBC Sports have extended their media rights agreement through 2033, inclusive of the Ryder Cup, KPMG Women's PGA Championship, Senior PGA Championship, and the PGA Professional Championship. The extension of the current agreement, which runs through 2031, is highlighted by the 2033 Ryder Cup at the Olympic Club in San Francisco, with live event and studio coverage continuing to air across NBC and USA Sports programs.
Lav, we gave you the honor at the top of the show, so we're going to start with Rex here with our eyes on world number one Scottie Scheffler. And Rex, this is interesting. He has one win so far this season. You go back the past 5 years through March 1, he's never had more than one win on the PGA Tour. But usually the month of March is where he really kicks it into gear. So from what you've seen the first couple months, what's your assessment of Scottie Scheffler, the 2026 version?
I don't know, George. Is he going to wake up Thursday morning and just hate Thursdays and decide just to kick the can until Friday, Saturday, and Sunday and do what he's done the last couple of starts, which is play like Scottie and Scheffler for the last three rounds and then play like Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner for the first round? I don't anticipate him to do that, to be honest with you. I think what we've seen over these last few starts is an anomaly because nothing else I can come up with makes sense. He has never done this in his career. There's no easy point to, you can just say, yes, he just doesn't like to play Thursday mornings. He likes to sleep in, whatever the case may be. And we kind of skip past that American Express win. If you were going to make an argument that Scottie Scheffler was going to struggle at any golf tournament on the PGA Tour, I might have said the American Express because it's a birdie fest. And over the course of his career, he's just proven to like the grinding events better, where par is a good score, not where you have to shoot 25 under. And yet he blew the field away there. So to your point, and to answer your question, I would be stunned if he only has one win as we get out of the Florida swing because he's played so well at Bay Hill. And he's played so well at TPC Sawgrass in the past.
Lav, I want to come to you with the same question. We were in Phoenix together where he still had a case of the Thursdays, kicked in the gear over the final three rounds. How dangerous is he going into this stretch of the year? As Rex said, with those wins at the Players back-to-back, the first ever in the then 50-year history of the PGA Tour flagship event, not to mention two wins at Arnie's Place as well.
I mean, he should be terrifying for the rest of the PGA Tour that he has not started better than 72 in his last three PGA Tour starts, and yet he's had at least an opportunity to win two of those three golf tournaments if he had just started a little bit better. I think it's obviously going to come to a head this week at Bay Hill. I'd be shocked if this is anything other than a statistical anomaly. You look at his career, the Arnold Palmer Invitational has never started worse than 71. As I mentioned, it's been 72 or worse over his last three tournaments as well, which is particularly puzzling because this is a player who led the PGA Tour in first round scoring average each of the last few years. And so I don't think this is anything. I don't think it's anything to be scared of. What I will be paying particular attention to this week at Bay Hill, which I think could portend success moving forward, is his iron play. Scottie Scheffler, at least in limited sample size in the PGA Tour this season, is 57th in strokes gained approach. It's been a little bit scratchy, particularly with his wedge play in short irons. That's very un-Scottie Scheffler-like. That is his superpower. That is why he's been in this dominant run over the past 4 years, needs to clean that up during the Florida swing, and I expect that he will.
For him to be double digits in any ball striking category is a shock, let alone 57th. So you would think there would be some positive regression to what has been the mean for Scheffler the past few years. We saw a positive Sunday for Brooks Koepka at PGA National to get a top 10 finish. I know for Brooks, historically, he sneezes at top 10s. He's usually there to win and win on the game's biggest stages. Do you think that can be the catalyst for something, or was that just a good round for Brooks?
I'll take this one, Rex. I think it was hugely important for Brooks Koepka. Easily the best performance of his season so far. Tied for fourth, greens in regulation, 21st off the tee. But the big change, the at least anomaly when you look in his 2026 stats, was the putting. He made 376 feet worth of putts for a player who couldn't buy anything in his first two starts at Torrey Pines and Phoenix. Did make a change with his putting coach, Jeff Pierce, on Thursday night, moving his hands a little bit further forward at address. I probably need to see more. I'm not ready to jump on the bandwagon that Brooks Koepka is back, but I do think it's very significant for him to get his first top 10, moved up significantly in the Aon top 10, the Swing 5, things of that nature as well. Keep in mind, he was brought back in the returning member program to compete against the best players in the world. Remember the PGA Tour tagline? This is where the best belong. Well, it's up to Brooks Koepka to hold up his end of the bargain as well. Needs to qualify for those signature events to go head-to-head against a Rory and a Scotty and a Tommy and a Xander Schauffele. It's up to Brooks Koepka. This was a huge step in the right direction for hopefully the rest of the spring and summer can be blockbuster as well.
What say you, Rex Hoggard? Brooks Koepka, final round 65. Exactly what he needed? Exactly what we needed to assess where he is? Or do you need to see more from the five-time major champ?
I'd like to see more. I'm not going to say this is mission accomplished because we all saw him on Thursday last week at PGA National. He struggled again with the putter, and what we saw at Torrey Pines, what we saw in Scottsdale was not good on the green. So I still need to see a little bit more. But when I spoke with him after the round on Friday, his words, not mine, he was cheating a little bit with his hands. He had gotten them a little bit forward. All it took was a rain session after his round on Thursday, and he looked much more like Brooks Koepka. And I think this is a bit of a milestone. He hasn't had a top 10 on tour since 2023. So even though Brooks, who seemed to kind of have that swagger in his step again last week, sort of dismissed it, I think this is a big move for him. And to Lab's point, he jumped up more than 50 spots on both those lists, Aon 5 and Aon 10, made a big move to try to get into those signature events.
Great to have Rex and Lab with us. They work very hard, especially on Sunday into Monday. And if you're in the market for a podcast, listen, folks, check out the Golf Channel podcast with the aforementioned Rex and Lab. And if you miss any of Golf Today, you can find our best interviews on the Golf Today podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page as well.
Only the best stuff
that
we
save. We save it for YouTube. Now, stay tuned, folks. Speaking of good interviews, we're going to chat with a world-long drive champ, Maurice Allen. He's going to join the show. He's known for his long drives and big personality, but he's got a new project which is helping to give back and serve members of the African-American golf community. That's next. And Long Drive Royalty joins us now, Maurice Allen. So nice to see you, my friend. We spoke a couple weeks ago about the shoes. How did the idea first come to mind for you?
Man, to be honest with you, it was something that when I first went to Adidas, this was a project I wanted to do. So this has been 4 years in the making. We got to this point and worked with Todd, who's a customizer at Adidas, and the whole Adidas team. This has been absolutely amazing, honestly.
And we see the huge collection behind you. To go from the ideation stage 4 years ago to now tangibly have the shoes, to get to that point, what's it like to see all that hard work finally come to fruition?
Honestly, the shoe was never about me. It was about representation. When you look at it, so often when we're in the game of golf, they're always talking about Black history, and we always pay homage to pioneers, as we should. But that history seems so far away. It seems 50, 60, 70 years ago. And we're in a space today where we have so many people who are currently doing things. And the recognition is something that I think needs to take place. You know, you have journeymen like Tim O'Neill, Willie Mack III, Kevin Hall. You've got on the women's side, Mariah Stackhouse, Lakarabie Abe. You've got young guns coming up on the men's side, Marcus Byrd, Greg Odom, Kamayu Johnson, Everett Whitten. You've got Amaya Avery on the women, Zoe Slaughter, Bailey Davis, Kendall Jackson. It's crazy. Then you look at the transition of how the programs collegiately have gone. You know, it started with Steph and Howard, and now FAMU has taken over, and they're doing some really, really amazing things. And then you've got a new young gun group of up and comings like Ashley Shaw and Shyla Brown that are really moving in this space for golf on the playing level, not in the influencer space, but on the playing level. And individuals like that are definitely needed to show other kids and other people that we can do this and that they have current people who are doing this and role models to look up to.
Well, Maurice, we know this shoe is the first of its kind. We'd love to see it and kind of understand how the idea for the artwork, for the choices that you made, how it all came together.
Sure. So the addition here was a limited friends and family colorway that we did. We took the Audi Power. We did the Pan-African flag. made it something very nice and classy, something that would go with pretty much any and everything that you want to put on and still represent Black History Month, being that this was the 100th year of Black History Month. And then there was a super limited 5-pair edition that had more of a tribal pattern on it that Todd came up with on his own. These things were absolutely ridiculously dope. And when he showed them to me, I was like, oh, and obviously time constraints, you know, you couldn't get everybody like that, but man, those, they were special. That one, this is 100% Todd. This is no Maurice at all. This was a surprise. So Todd did his thing on this one. He definitely showed up and showed out with that 100%.
Yeah. You love to see it. And Maurice, golf fans familiar with your name from what you've done with your long drive career. There's kind of a next chapter with other projects or programs that you've been working with, like Chicago State. What can you share with us on how that came to be and the impact you're trying to have with that golf program?
Yeah, for me, it was interesting because in the sport where I gained my, I guess, fame, I never knew about the people who came before me. For instance, Jim Dent, always going to bring him up anytime I talk about long drive, but Chicago State came around because I know Coach Macon, and being an individual who did not have a roadmap, trying to give the next flock and the next generation a roadmap so they can understand the things that have gone on and how to set their own path and how to put their own mark on this game. And they're not an HBCU, they're a predominantly Black institution, and golf is a non-revenue sport. It needed help. And I had a connection with them, and ironically, one of the kids, Jalen, if you go back to my loss that must have been 2015 when I lost to Tim Burke and I yelled at a ball that went out of bounds. There's a video, I think Jalen was 8 or 9 at the time, and he mimicked that. He brought a smile to my face. And now to see him actually playing on that team and getting a pair of the shoes that are the first Black History Month shoes and going full circle with that, it's something that lets you know how amazingly special this whole moment was. And for Chicago State to help just give those kids some sense of pride and something just to let people know that we see what they're doing and they're trying their best, and just to really sow a seed into those young people.
Maurice, at the same time that you released this shoe, you wrote a very powerful letter to friends about your own personal journey in golf. And you said it really didn't start with you. You gave a lot of love to your father. I'm curious, you know, what stories did he tell you about what it was like for him to try to play this game?
Everything I do, I'm a combination of my parents and my grandparents and my great grandparents. I was blessed enough to be around all of those three generations, and I learned from each and every one of them. My dad, it's awesome because 2 years ago, I almost lost my dad to a stroke, and he's the person who put the club in my hand to start. He's the one who had this dream that I was going to be something in the game of golf, no matter how much I fought it. And so for him to still be alive, for my parents to still be alive, for my pops to still be alive, and for them to see that, you know, the kid who was running track and painting his hair all kinds of weird colors and things of that nature turned out to do something good and listen to all the lessons that they gave me is the most important part of this whole ordeal, honestly, for me.
Maurice, distance is such a hot button topic in the world of not just professional golf, but the game of golf. And having seen you compete up close at the World Long Drive Championship, what you can do with a driver in hand is jaw-dropping. And obviously there are changes coming to how the professional game is going to look as far as the golf ball that's going to be used. How do you view the direction of where World Long Drive is going in the near future?
I think now with the flux of YouTube and things of that nature, I think we're in an amazing space where this game can grow. I think that the sport is doing a great job at going back to the grassroots and then building the fan base and growing and allowing that to happen. I see long drive hopefully in the next couple of years surpassing what it was in 17 and 18, and I think they have a good plan on doing that. There's definitely the group that's at adrenaline-based young crowd, that's what they want. They want that hit the ball far. And as you see with the different things going on at the ranges and the different shot tracing and top tracing and all these other different things that are happening, you're getting more people access to this game, if nothing else than just going to the range. And so I think that you'll have more athletes coming out and doing this, and I think it'll grow big time.
Well, Maurice, if you get a knock on your door anytime in the next couple of days, it could be my three teenage sons wanting to take a look at that incredible shoe closet. My friend, it's great to visit with you. Thank you so much for sharing your story and what you're doing with Adidas and the shoe, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Hey, thank you guys so much. Thanks to the whole Adidas crew and Todd and everybody who made this possible. Could not have happened without them. So, like I said, we're my brother for all those who helped along the way. I really appreciate everybody.
Great to see you, Maurice.
Thanks, guys.
Time now for another Golf Today Roundtable. Let's welcome in Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols and Grant Boone from our LPGA coverage. Thanks for spending part of your Monday with us. Beth Ann, it would look like a dream start if you look at the paper. Nelly gets a win. Gino gets a win. Charlie Hall, LET, back to Hannah Green. Has it been a dream start? The cold weather controversy in Orlando notwithstanding. Is it resonating, Beth Ann?
Well, in terms of winners, I don't think you could ask for much more. Unfortunately, I think with most of that winning happening on the other side of the world, it doesn't resonate so much here. But you can't deny what we saw in Thailand with Gino Tinakun and what an absolute triumph that was all the way around. When you look at those crowds, those are some of the biggest crowds that, you know, the players will see all year. So certainly, you know, this Asian swing is important for the LPGA. It's important for the growth of the tour. But when you have the TOC on an island, Grant and I were just talking about this last night a little bit, you know, it really does feel like the LPGA doesn't really start in earnest until late March.
Grant, we've had recent seasons on the LPGA Tour where you can have a dominant player or players, or you're like last year where every week you look up and it seems like there's a new winner emerging. Small sample size, just a couple months in, but do you have a gauge if someone is going to separate themselves as a clear-cut dominant player, or are we going to have a rotating cast of characters?
Well, here's what I know, George, and we say this a lot. We say this on the LPGA broadcast. We talk about this, Beth Ann and I do. It's never been harder to win on the LPGA Tour than it is right now. And so a year like last year, I don't think is terribly surprising. We saw a ton of 11 first-time winners, a handful of rookies won. That being said, I think with Nelly and Gino having already won, Hannah Green lost in Nelly's 7-win season a couple of years ago. Hannah Green won 3 times, and a couple of those were middle of the night in America, and so not everybody saw them during football season, one of them, but I think there's every reason to believe that these four who've already won this year, Charlie won against a field that was half full of LPGA players, and it got more ranking points than some of the lower tier LPGA events. So I think when you look at the four winners this year, there's every reason to believe that at least a couple of them are going to rattle off 3 or 4. I've said that Gino, who's at 10 Hall of Fame points when the year began, I think she's got a great chance to double that this year. I really think Gino is going to have not just a good year, but she's always a big top 10 player. I think this is the year that those begin getting converted, not just a couple of wins, but maybe 3 or 4, could be even more than that.
I'm with you, Grant. I think she's headed for an historic season. But Beth Ann, it wouldn't be an LPGA season without an occasional check of the state of American women's golf ducks, as I ask the question. What would you say? I mean, Nelly, one of the biggest names in our sport, but only 3 players from the United States in the top 25. Problematic? Cyclical? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I you know, I'm hopeful though. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we only saw 3 Americans win last year. Obviously, Nelly Korda was not among them. And what you're seeing is a national program in its infancy in the U.S., whereas the rest of the world has been doing this for decades now and are reaping the rewards of that. So, you know, I do think that America's playing catch up right now, and it's going to take a little bit of time before we see the youth coming through here, because, you know, we haven't seen an American phenom in a while. We thought that Rose Zhang was going to fill a hole there that so far she has not. I think you have to go down to maybe an asterisk tally as the next up and coming player to really get excited about. But you know, when we look at the Olympics in the past, we've seen 4 players qualify that have been ranked in the top 15 in the world. And it's possible that come 2028, there's only two Americans in LA.
Yeah, let me jump in there if I could. I think it is cyclical. I mean, for four straight years, the U.S. had the most wins and the most different winners on the LPGA Tour of any country. I'm not giving up on Rose Zhang, by the way. she went through a little bit of an injury, and she really focused heavily on school last year. She's about to graduate. I still think there's reason to believe that Rose Zhang is going to have a whole lot of wins in her future. I look at the up-and-comers this year. Yana Wilson's going to be a rookie. She's a USGA champion. Melanie Green won the British Amateur a couple of years ago, first time in 20 years that an American had won that event. More than 20, almost 20 years, yeah, since Kelly Keeney. She's coming off the Epson Tour. Eight of the top 11 on the Epson Tour last year were Americans. And when I look at the women's amateur golf rankings, five of the top 10, including number one, Kiara Romero, Mega Gane are right there. So yes, Beth Ann's right. Only three winners last year on the LPGA Tour from the U.S. And that was the fewest in a decade. But I think you can look at a couple of mitigating factors. Allie Ewing, you know, last year was in the top 25. She stepped away to have a family. And to me, this is more of a reset. And it's also yet another indication of how global the LPGA Tour is. There are fewer wins to be had when you have four of the top players from the Japan LPGA Tour money list come over and all get wins like they did last year.
I mean, they made such a big splash last year in 2025. One of those names in recent years that would have been a name to watch as a young phenom, Ingrid Lindblad, who's fallen on some hard times, had that really tough finish in her last start. Beth Ann, is this a speed bump, or is this going to be a longer curve for her to dig it out of this?
Well, I'm hoping that it's just a speed bump. The fact that she can be open and honest about it in the middle of it, I think, is a really great sign. Usually players don't want to talk about these things until they're on the other side of it. So, you know, I'm certainly hopeful for Ingrid. You know, I was talking to Erica Shepherd, a promising young rookie on tour earlier this year, about the fact that she got the shanks not long after she turned professional, playing on the Epson Tour, all of a sudden playing some of the worst golf of her life. And Erica played college golf at Duke, USGA champion. You know, there's so many players that have stories like this where out of nowhere, it feels like, you know, you get hit by a freight train, you don't know where the ball's going. And that's Ingrid Lindblad right now. And I'm confident that she can find her way again.
Grant, and she can look, by the way, to a player like Lily Avu, who, you know, lost her game completely. Like Ingrid, a former number one ranked amateur, almost gave the game up, came back and was player of the year, number one in the world, two-time major champion. There are probably more like Ingrid, maybe not with a score like she put up in Singapore, but they're way more like her than those who just cruise and never have any speed bumps.
Grant, what do you think of the post, though, on Instagram saying, you know, doubting yourself on every tee box is exhausting? I mean, she really was open, honest, and emotional with the depth of the struggle.
Well, I'm thinking of Damon Yu and Beth Ann, who are part of the Golf Writers Association of America. We're seeing a switch now in how athletes deal with media. It used to be they would talk to reporters from newspapers or other outlets after rounds, and now they're able to go straight to their fans, which I think in a case like this, as Beth Ann said, is refreshing. It is raw, as you say. But for Ingrid, she's got a great support team. Her mom travels with her every week on the LPGA Tour. She's got friends out there. The Swedish contingent is very tight. They cheer each other on. They all had a great year last year with four different winners, including Ingrid. But again, I would look at Lily Avu and others who struggle when they first come out on tour. And Ingrid last year, I think, is a good example of how we define success based on wins and losses. Ingrid did not have a great year last year. She had an incredible week, but even on the back nine at the JM Eagle LA Championship at El Cab, she hit a horrible left tee shot that bounced out of the trees into the fairway. And if that doesn't happen, there's no guarantee that she keeps her card. So for Ingrid, she did get it done when it mattered. She can lean on that, as Lily did, past success, got the team around her. I appreciate the fact that these players are willing to at least share a bit of themselves with us. We saw that with Shane Lowry, didn't we, yesterday on the men's side. Just he didn't have to do that. He was generous, I thought, incredibly generous with where he was inside.
You know, Bethann, we've talked about the strength of Japanese golf, Swedish golf. How about the strength coming from Australia? It seems to be like we're in this generation of players who grew up, you know, loving Kari Webb. I'm talking about Minji Lee, Hannah Green, Grace Kim, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I look at Kari just implemented a new 4-day training camp for elite athletes who are coming all over from Australia. 12 girls that could potentially be part of her scholarship program, like Minji and Hannah Green and Grace were, and these young players had an opportunity to play with Kari, had an opportunity to ask her anything they want, and meet a lot of the support staff that Golf Australia has. And so, you know, when I look at the kind of mentor that Kari Webb has been for all of these young players, so available, so willing. You know, I remember walking around with Kari in 2019 and Hazeltine when Hannah Green won that major championship, and how proud Kari was. And so I think having that figurehead that you can rely on and aspire to, and she keeps pushing the bar, you know, adding this new 4-day camp is a fabulous thing, where she's getting to them even earlier than she has been. You know, it's just invaluable what she's been able to instill in these young players. And I started thinking, who can do that for the American players? You know, Julie Inkster has a great program, a workday scholarship for the top senior player in college golf. You know, they get a retreat with her and actually a boatload of cash, which is great when you're a young starting professional. But that's just not for American players. And that's just one winner every year. And so, you know, I would love to see an American player sort of step up and fill that void. I know Morgan Pressel fields a lot of phone calls and does a lot of things for young players behind the scenes.
Will be a fast
by the way, go, on that go. Note, Julie Inkster, we can't announce it yet. We may see her talk about mentoring, playing in an LPGA event this summer. Can't tell you. Little tease.
Whoa. Keeping us back.
Who already is the least young player to ever make a cut on the LPGA Tour. I'm not ruling out a win when you hear where she's going
to
play.
What a nice way to put that. The least young player to ever make a cut.
least youthful.
That's very strategic. Strategic from Mr. Boone. Great to have you and Beth and two of the best in the business.
Marty Jaramillo, a sports injury analyst, physical therapist, has worked with high-profile athletes for the better part of 3 decades. Marty, let's start with JT, who's making his return. What can you share as far as the procedure he had done and what the near-term outlook will be now that he's back inside the ropes?
Well, Damon, George, so great to be here. Well, Justin Thomas has decided to make his return to the PGA Tour, having undergone a microdiscectomy this past November. And let me tell you, by choosing Bay Hill as his return tournament, well, that's nothing short of a statement indeed. But first, let's talk a little bit about what he went through. A microdiscectomy is considered a minimally invasive procedure where a surgeon removes the torn disc that is pressing on the nerve, causing chronic pain. And in his case, it caused chronic pain specifically in his hips and affected every metric of his swing. Much shorter comeback, about 12 weeks, we're way past that. And it's because it's minimally invasive, his motion is 100% unaffected, just endurance and stamina. And for the average golfer, it's so less about pain tolerance and more about endurance over time. And in his case, it's about those 4 days, 72-hole grueling days at Bay Hill.
MJ, you said it was a statement to make the return at Bay Hill. We know it's one of the toughest courses these players will face all season, thick, rough, U.S. Open-like. Why do you believe it's a statement that he's returning to Arnie's Place?
That's a great question. First, let's talk about what the viewers and fans should look out for as he makes his return, not only at Bay Hill, but for future tournaments. Well, one, we have to look at is the freedom of his finish. Is he fully holding that finish at the end of the swing, or is there any sign of deceleration or hesitation, a potential sign of fatigue? Second thing we're looking for is that ground-up sequencing. Is he initiating that downswing with his legs? But if, because of the leg fatigue, you have tremendous amount of compensations and become more of an upper body, handsy, arms swing. And then in the late rounds, we're looking for, is hole 16 look like hole one? Is Sunday looking like Thursday? All signs of how well and potential I was going to look in future rounds. But why is Bay Hill such a test, and what I think it's such a statement, an impressive statement, I really believe. One, as you mentioned, Damon, was the thick rough. That thick rough, you have to really increase your strength, your speed through that rough, through impact. But what does that do? Increases torque and stress on the spine. The second thing is the length of the course at over 7,400 yards. Well, those long irons, more demand on the spine, faster swing speeds, more aggressive transitions. And let's not forget the wind. We have to swing harder and faster to break through some of the wind. So between the rough, the length, his issues with his back, coming back, I really felt he is telling the community at large, I am back and ready to play at one of the toughest courses on the tour.
Marty, you look, let's use the NFL as an example. If you had an ACL injury, 70s or 80s, that could be the end of a career. Now we see guys bouncing back who have similar type of burst or even more so post dealing with an ACL recovery. In golf, we've had these micro discectomy surgeries. And then if you look in the last 15 years, Jamie Lovemark, Graham Dillette, Kevin Chappell, Tiger Woods, Justin Thomas now, it's been a tough road to recovery to regain the same form. Is the procedure more or less the same as it was 10 to 15 years ago, or have there been advancements to prolong guys' careers?
That's a great question. Without question, every year that procedure becomes even more straightforward and very less taxing on the body as well. These procedures that take you away from the game 3, 4, 5 months, sometimes a full season, I've reported on this many times, especially what you mentioned, the NFL, basketball. When you have these type of injuries, day one, day two, chaos. What's going to happen to my career? What am I going to do? When am I going to have surgery? Who's going to do it? How long am I going to be out? All those things. But when all that settles, these type of procedures are nothing short of an opportunity to get your mind straight, your body straight, some time away from the game that's causing all these stresses. And it really is such a different mindset as it used to be. It used to be this gloom and doom. Now it's like, okay, I got a chance to just take a break and work on all those limitations within my body that may have caused these injuries in the first place.
How about Tiger Woods, age 50, has not ruled out a return to the Masters. He's had multiple disc herniations and back surgeries and foot and leg issues. Is the biggest challenge for him back-related? Is it ankle-related? How do you see it?
Damon, that's such a great question. Well, Tiger Woods, a.k.a. the GOAT, has dangled the carrot as only he can that there might be a return at the Masters. So Tiger and JT share the same surgeon, the masterful Shiraz Qureshi at the renowned Hospital for Special Surgery. But their procedures couldn't be so different. Justin Thomas, microdiscectomy. Well, let's call that a clean out. Pressure on the nerve removed. Pain is gone, build up endurance, you're back within 3 much shorter recovery. Now with Tiger, not a clean out, a complete reconstruction. Remember in 2017, he had the spinal fusion, the lowest level L5-S1 was fused. 2 years later, wins the Masters, but the stress and torque is on the level above at L4, L5. And at some point, it just broke down. But once again, with some of the advances, he had an artificial disc replacement. Let me say that again. Artificial disc replacement, not unlike total knee replacement, not unlike total hip replacement, but much longer recovery. We're moving on 5, 6 months. And to your exact point, it is so much more about all the surgeries that he had. At last count, there's over 13 surgeries, combination of his back and lower legs, ACL, Achilles. What I'm most concerned about is both his foot and ankles. Left side, tore his Achilles training for last year's Masters. Right side had to be fused because of the chronic pain he had following the car accident. So we know about this kinetic sequence, the ground up. If the feet and ankles aren't doing their job, they're not dissipating forces. Where does that force go? It goes upwards, knee, hip, and of course, back, which is already compromised. So that, I do agree with you. I know where you were going with that, that the future success on the PGA Tour, the Champions Tour, less about his back. Why? Well, he won the Masters after a lumbar fusion. We know he can recover well from that, but we've also seen him limping severely after third and fourth day at Augusta. So I really feel it's his ankle limitations, left leg force output, but also right leg developing that load to create that downward tilt. So I really think it's the ankle issue about his next chapter and when that potential retirement happens. I do want to know what the over-under is about him ever being in a golf cart.
I think that's when people would love to try and see him on PGA Tour Champions. If the body struggles to walk four rounds in the PGA Tour, cart PGA Tour Champions would at least be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
MJ, good to be with you here on Golf Today, and I appreciate all the insights.
Thank you, John.